You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Lacrosse Boots. Now, if you haven't heard yet, this is me telling you, you need to take a look at the new boots from Lacrosse, and they fall under the Navigator series. Now, what they've done is they've taken the best parts of a rubber boot and the best parts of your traditional hiking and hunting boot, and they've mashed them together to come up with this new line of boots from Lacrosse, and that is the Navigator series. Now, they have the women's Windrose, they have the men's Windrose, and then they have the Atlas series within that as well. So go to lacrossefootwear.com and check out this new line of boots that they have. I've been using mine for a couple weeks now, and I am very impressed with the fit and the feel, and I can't wait to get them in the woods this hunting season and give them a trial run. So lacrossefootwear.com, check them out.
Hey guys, welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. This is your host, Adam Keith. We're co-owners of a consulting company called, go figure, Land and Legacy. This is your number one podcast resource for all things land.
Each week, we're breaking down topics from land management, habitat management, conservation, farming practices, and real estate. We hope you guys enjoy it.
Welcome back, guys. Another Land and Legacy Podcast. Host Adam Keith.
Matt Dye is here as well. Man, we're ready for this podcast.
That's right.
We got a good one.
Yeah, and we're going to take a little bit of a
turn.
I think because a lot of people that listen to this podcast aren't just hunters.
Totally.
If you were to poll our audience or listenership, you'd probably find that a lot of guys are here not for our hunting tactics, but for our land management tactics. So even though we are in the middle of Missouri archery season, a lot of other, this will drop, I guess, in October.
The first of October,
so
right?
Yep. By then, a lot of states will be opening up or have opened up by then. We're going to take a little bit of a turn because of the time of the year. Yep. And it's weighing on a lot of guys' brains. We've had this question. I had this question yesterday at our QDMA cooperative event in Kirksville, Missouri, asking about cattle, wildlife, properties. Properties that have cows, that's what pays for the farm. That's why they own the ground, but they also enjoy hunting. And when you have that, you have a whole new set of obstacles. But at the same time, you have the ability to have income produced off the farm, food produced off the farm from an outside, from not just wild game, but also for
beef, from livestock. Yeah,
from livestock, and so finding ways to have benefits to both is a big part of what we do. It's a big part of our background. We both were raised around cattle farms, and we get asked all the time, can it be done? And I think back to the podcast we did with Dan Johnson over on Nine Finger Chronicles when he asked us to describe our ideal farm, and I think he probably was very shocked when we said, I know I said that I yep. wanted cows to be on that farm yep. as a management tool, not just as income produced. And if you're looking at the management tool side of it, go and listen to the podcast with Kyle Hedges talking about the quail research and how using cattle in a rotational setup benefited the quail better than not grazing, basically. And because of the rankness and thickness of the grass and vegetation, especially Eastern United States.
There's a lot of people who have had experiences with cattle farms that basically are, let's say, mismanaged. And so their experiences have skewed the mindset of the benefits that cattle on the landscape, on farms, working farms that are managed appropriately, the benefits that it can have. And so with that mismanagement that a lot of people have experienced, it often leads to this conflict of wildlife and cattle. And so we are here from our experiences to say, hey, listen, let's just take a few steps back. Let's understand both systems and understand how we can find that happy middle ground. And we've talked, you know, in past podcasts about general topics, but not really just devoted one to pasture management and how you can improve pastures and hay ground for wildlife.
And this is, I guess, forewarned, this is just scratching the surface.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Of pastures and how to make them more wildlife friendly, more focus on soil health, the whole ecosystem, the whole holistic mindset of looking at a pasture and saying, how can I make this more beneficial, not only to the wildlife, but for the cattle as well.
Oh, yeah.
Diversity is a hugely important thing, especially in getting through tough situations, whether that be drought, whether that be lots of rain.
Some of the best cattle farms that we know have been on, have experiences with, they weather the storms, whether it is intense rainfall, intense snow, or drought-like conditions. They manage those situations, the tough times where a lot of people throw in the towel or just resort to feeding hay in pastures during those stress periods. They do that, and they can do that, and fare very well because of the diverseness of those pastures and the forages that are in there. It's not just a solo grass or a base of, let's just say, fescue or smooth brome or orchard grass. That's not just the one forage that they're relying on to make the income to feed the cattle. It's no different from wildlife, what we talk about all the time that you guys hear us talk about, diversity within your property to offer all these different things. Same thing with cattle, but that diversity with cattle, there's a lot of overlapping, say, forages and benefits that, again, benefit the wildlife side of things too.
Absolutely. Think back to my family farm. This year we had a pretty wet summer.
Yeah.
We had more rainfall than average. It got dry in August, and it's been dry ever since. And we have the front hay field, and we've talked a lot about hay in the past, but let's just focus on improving hay ground, whether it's good or not, or long-term. Hay's there, hay pasture, and we're trying to make this better. What has my dad done over the last few years to that area is whenever they cut the hay, and then there's bales that are there, and they set for till he gets them hauled off, so a few days, maybe a week or so, and you get those bare spots. He's been throwing in red clover.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now there's an overabundance of red clover, or not overabundance. There's a very abundant amount of red clover in the front hayfield. And this summer, there's not a lot of acorns on the ground yet. It got pretty dry. The food plots were providing food, but not because there's not a lot of big destination food plots on the farm, so they're kind of just little transition plots. We would see multiple deer every night.
We saw
right at sunset.
One
there
of
was
the
that.
Key bachelor groups that we that we had our eyes on. Lots of does and fawns. But that goes to show right there, from a diversity standpoint, that's just one additional forage in the it's a fescue and orchard grass pasture.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of diversity in it.
No, but it goes to show during midsummer when you add something like red clover, which is peaking in June, July, and even later when you have the adequate rains, my gosh, what it provides. And it provided the wildlife a huge benefit. And this is coming, let's say, off the heels, and I want to just focus here on Missouri because there's this wildlife livestock, let's say, conflict that doesn't need to be a conflict, but it's present everywhere we go. Every state that we're in, you know, we run into these, let's say, discussions and issues. But Missouri, for instance, I believe it was, just using this because the numbers are fresh, but 88% of Missouri's land is privately owned. And on top of that, there's the last number I saw was 17 million acres in Missouri of tall fescue. And so how much of the landscape and privately managed land is dominated by cattle? I think we're the third largest cattle producing state in the country. And it's like, if we want to make the state and make a large impact across the state to our wildlife, not just deer, but turkey, to rabbits, to quail, all these different things, we've got to look at big land masses that we're going to affect.
I'm looking now because I was thinking we were somewhere a little bit lower. This is saying that we're fifth, sixth, but I'm sure that can change. This shows Texas, Nebraska, Kansas, California, and Oklahoma ahead of us.
Ahead of us. So sixth. Let's just say we're around the top five-ish cattle-producing states.
Well, and we know based on listenership that we have a lot of guys in Oklahoma and Kansas and Nebraska and Texas that listen.
Yeah.
So they can relate to this as well.
For sure.
And you know, it's important to note, like, we encourage our landowners to find ways to make money off the farm. That's a big part of our business of going, how can you help pay for the farm rather than making it completely recreational, paying everything out of pocket?
That puts stress on families and the land itself.
And so cattle is a big one. If used correctly, can be not only beneficial to the landscape, but beneficial from a financial gain.
Yes.
And so it's important. If you are looking to add cattle to the farm or improve the cattle operation on your farm, to be aware of things you can do to make it more wildlife friendly.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Again, it goes back to that happy medium between the two of them. And I think it's important to start out with just a simple base. And hopefully everyone who listens to the podcast, we've thrown it out enough. But just the definition of cool season perennial grasses and given some examples. These are grasses, a lot of them that are presently used are non-native, and they're mat-forming grasses typically.
Turf, yeah.
Turf-forming grasses, so they are very dominant when planted, and obviously their peaked times are during the cooler seasons of the year. So let's say tall fescue, smooth brome, orchard grass, Timothy. There's some variances in those peaks of those forages, but those are examples of cool season perennial grasses.
Did you say ryegrass?
I did not say perennial ryegrass, okay. But that's another one.
Yeah, those are kind of like
that's a key one though too.
The big five.
Yeah, yeah. Kentucky bluegrass is another pretty big one. But all that being said, they're peaking from, you know, much of their climate where they're produced at March through early June, and then they're peaking again from September, October, potentially beginning of November.
Yeah, and here in Missouri, November, they're phenomenal.
Oh, yeah.
Especially tall fescue and orchard grass.
Yep.
And so those are the most popular non-native cool season pasture grasses or hay ground grasses.
Everyone has probably had experiences with those.
Yeah.
So, but they got here basically because things were mismanaged in the first place, truthfully.
Yeah.
And they needed these types of grasses to fill voids in the grazing, the management, to extend grazing seasons, and to improve the number of livestock or animal units on properties.
Yeah, because with those grasses, specifically tall fescue, you can graze it hard and
hard.
It comes back.
Yes, very hard. It's a very resilient grass. You can hay it, you can graze it, you can beat it into the dirt, and it comes back. So it's a very forgiving.
It's like a very loyal dog. You can beat it and beat it and beat it, and it just keeps coming back.
Not that you've ever done that.
No.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, so quick joke. You know what true love is, man? Never mind, I'm not going to tell that joke.
We don't need any more emails after jokes from Adam. So that's a quick little definition and examples of cool season perennial grasses that you find in common pastures. And what you also find in pastures is an additional legume that's added. And typically it's your pretty simple white clover.
Yeah.
White clover in one of these grasses. So a broadleaf and a grass added to a pasture and call it good. Get the animal units on there, graze it, hay it, whatever, and you walk
away. Reseed it again in the fall with some more
beef it up.
Clover.
So and all that sounds good, and without a doubt, I can't tell you how many deer I've shot foraging in pastures in my lifetime, just because so much of my childhood was brought up on
and not
cattle.
It's important to note, not eating tall fescue.
Exactly. That was the point I was going into, is like, the reason they were in pastures is because of the legume that was added or present there, not because of the grass component. If deer are eating and foraging on fescue or these other perennial cool season grasses that we just mentioned, that's not a good thing. And just because they're in those pastures again doesn't mean that is the forage they are selecting to eat. They're a concentrate selector, so they're eating the fresh, the tender, the ends on clover, most likely, or these other forages that we can add into. But white clover, red clover, like you mentioned,
yep,
and then alfalfa, birchfoot trefoil, some lespedezas are other legumes.
Certainly
that
not
be,
cerisa.
Yes,
lespedezas. It's important to note too. I would encourage every one of our listeners, if you haven't already, download an app or get a ID book. The iNaturalist app is a really good one to ID what, if you don't know what kind of grasses your grandpa has in one of his pastures or this area, yeah, that you're focusing in on after listening to this podcast, know for certain what you have, because
totally,
if you have tall fescue has an allelopathic tendency. So like, as we get into this, certain species aren't going to do well in a tall fescue pasture overseeding.
Yes.
For instance, like some of your fall annuals. But your perennials would do great. Your clovers,
yes,
chicories, things like that.
Especially things that fill the void between the cool season peaks like we talked about. If you have additional forages, legume forages in these pastures that are peaking during the June to through August timeframe, now you've really maximized your potential within that pasture. And that's what you just talked about from your story there, Adam, was, hey, we've started seeing a lot of red clover popping up. What time frame did we see that red clover pop? And what time frame were we seeing deer actively foraging a lot in that front hayfield? Well, that was during the peak window for those added legumes and not the cool season grasses. So you took acres that were just dominated by cool season grasses in a lot of places across the entire country, and you've understood that, let's say, growing cycle of the cool season grass and extended the opportunities for beyond livestock and said, okay, during these months, because of these forages I'm adding, I'm going to improve the effectiveness or the carrying capacity of this property during the summer by adding things like white clover, red clover, alfalfa, the chicory into these systems. We've seen a humongous peak, just the revival blend itself, honestly, from Stratton. The reason we put all those forages right there together is because each one hit a different peak. And it's funny, like, okay, that white clover, typically, that's not a great summertime. It's more of a cool season, kind of mimics.
It does really good in May and June, April, May, June.
Yes.
Not so great in July and August.
Not great really at all. But it's funny that, okay, in most common pastures, what do you find? You find that cool season grass and that white clover component, and they're two forages that have like the exact same peaks, and you cut it once and then you get hot, dry weather, and then that all those acres are just sitting there pretty much idle and not growing that much unless you're getting rains and cooler temperatures to make those pastures and those paddocks, the growing season, the peak of when you should have the most opportunity and forage capabilities on a farm for both livestock and for wildlife. You've got two grasses or two vegetation types that are not doing jack squat out there. And that doesn't make sense to me from a productiveness of the land. If you're just focusing on cattle, why do you do that?
And it's just like, as much as people by now know we love native grasses, love native plants in general, but let's just say, I think when we did our plant animal profile, our top picks, you picked gamma grass.
Eastern gamma grass. Yep.
Eastern gamma grass is a phenomenal native warm season grass.
Mm-hmm.
It has a peak, not like a lot of the other really popular ones.
Right, right.
And we could say, yeah, we love eastern gamma grass, but we don't love it so much that we're going to go plant an entire field of it.
No.
Because we would sit and watch
It has its peak.
Phenomenal
its
peaking in May and June, and then we would sit there in and July and August
and
be like,
right over.
Where the heck did that go? And then especially when you get in the cool seasons later in the fall and winter, we'd be going, man, we planted that and we devoted everything. We put all of our
eggs
in one basket, and we're doing that same thing when we plant a monoculture of any species for that matter.
Yeah.
But specifically in hay pastures or grazing pastures, we're looking to get peaks. What we're trying to do is get a peaking plant or multiple plants peaking throughout the entire growing season.
And that's why it's important to, again, identify what grasses and components are part of these fields and knowing when they peak and when they don't peak. And if you have these gaps, it's just, again, it goes back to identifying. When we go to a property, Adam, we're going out there, we're consulting, we're evaluating the landscape, evaluating what vegetation types are there. And what we're trying to identify is basically the weakest times of the year that this property is performing or not performing or living up to what it needs to be to carry the deer. So you as a landowner or as a hunter, maybe you're in a lease situation where you can't really do anything to the pasture. You can't spray them out. You can't add old field. You can't add food plots. But what you can do is go into these pastures and hay fields and identify what's the weak spot. What time frame is this cattle farmer missing? And by this podcast, now you're understanding that there's other forages that can be added that will, yes, help extend the haying opportunities, the forage opportunities from cattle, but directly benefit wildlife as well by adding alfalfa, by adding red clover, possibly if you need to bump up the density or concentration of clover, white clover, into the fields.
Yeah,
we haven't even gotten to the annual situation though either.
Or
you can add to,
or even talk about down south the difference of a lot of their pastures are warm season,
straight warm season, no cool season,
and even Oklahoma or Kansas, we can talk about warm season pastures of Bermuda grass,
Bahia grass, another one,
Bahia grass, Bermuda grass, Johnson grass.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to think if there's any other that come to mind. I think that's kind of the big three that you really see a lot of. And all three of those are going to be too doggone thick
Bermuda
is very tough.
It's so aggressive. Watery grass.
Here's what I'm going to say. Bermuda grass is one of those that turns off pretty stinking early in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
You see Bermuda grass on a lot of golf courses, a lot of baseball fields. And even before that real hard frost.
You don't have to get a hard frost at all.
It's already turning.
Exactly.
And the great thing, we offered this advice to a listener last year that had a pasture down south of Bermuda grass, and he was looking to add some sort of benefit to the wildlife. So he got approval, I think, from his grandpa or his dad, and he overseeded some cool season annuals. He didn't do perennials because they were scared that it was going to
be competitive.
Competitive, right. And it was going to outcompete the Bermuda. So he put in crimson clover and like wheat and oats, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And what they
just
found,
like a broadcast situation.
Broadcast.
Into a dormant Bermuda.
Into dormant Bermuda.
Okay.
And it turned into a phenomenal food plot.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to get another cutting off that, but instead of cutting Bermuda,
which
they
would
cut,
have been delayed,
they would have
into
been waiting
year.
For it to start growing in the warm season,
mm-hmm.
and growing and then cut it. They cut early and cut that
cover crop, basically.
Cover crop, and were able to get additional forage for the cattle as well as all forage long or all fall and winter forage for the wildlife.
So that's the importance of understanding what in the world, first off, is growing in the pastures, what peaks does it have, and how can I supplement and carry this through? Because we've covered in another podcast more talking about, you know, stratton mixes and what's in there, but what we've covered is the peak windows for all those additional forage, these fall annuals, and the roles that they play. Because when you're looking at like the grasses, the wheat, the oat, the triticale, the cereal rye, if you're adding those components into a pasture like a warm season pasture down south, like you just mentioned there in Bermuda, you've got growing conditions down to 35, 36 degrees or so, soil temperatures, where it can germinate and still continue to grow. And that's a really low soil temperature for southern states. So you've just maximized the amount of, or the ability for those acres to be totally productive from both yet a wildlife standpoint and a livestock standpoint. It's incredible to take, okay, productiveness from a cattle standpoint or livestock standpoint, or the farm operation, and say, really, we're peaking out at 9 months out of the year, this farm is growing something that cattle are eating. Those other 3 months, we're feeding hay, we're supplementing with something else. But what you can do as a hunter and come to the right appropriate landowner with the right information and say, actually, let's take this on into a 11, 12-month operation. We can do it by doing this. And then now you're also increasing the opportunity to either cut silage on that cover crop, the food plot, whatever you want to call it.
Graze it during the winter.
Graze it during the winter time, or cut it for hay and bale it for baleage. Whatever you want to do, there's those opportunities. So
I got another friend that has a multi-use property, cattle and wildlife. And he planted, last year, he planted the Stratton Legacy blend.
Mm-hmm.
I think he grazed it 2 or 3 times. Grazed
this was
it,
the Cattleman's Treasure, correct?
No, Legacy.
This was the Legacy,
Legacy
blend.
Yep.
Okay.
He grazed it multiple times. Now, the Cattleman's Treasure is more heavy on the grass, the cereal mm-hmm. grains, to try and have that ability to really put some tonnage on the ground and tonnage in the, out for the cattle. But he grazed it a couple of times. Late fall, early winter, then again late winter, and then again in the spring, grazed it. And every time it was just for a short period, you know, send them on,
quick,
they move through, whatever. It's I don't know how many animal units they were running per
yeah.
acre there, but it was definitely, he ran his whole herd on it. And then he turned around and he said, when the cows weren't there, the deer were, and the other wildlife
sure.
were.
Sure.
And then he turned around and he planted the Heritage blend.
Mm-hmm.
He did add some sorghum sedan just to get that very popular summer grazing
mm-hmm.
of an annual out
from,
there.
From the livestock standpoint.
Yes.
Yep.
And grazed it so where now he's got this area that's basically a big food plot that gets the cattle through it a couple of times, but they don't completely eat everything. And then so he's getting a benefit, really,
oh,
free
huge.
Fertilizer.
Yep.
He's getting to fatten up his cows.
Yep.
And he's getting to feed the wildlife.
And shoot some deer.
And shoot some deer.
Well, and here's the thing. Let's just say you find yourself in that position or that opportunity to do something similar to that on a property you hunt, you own, whatever it may be. If you go to a landowner and say, hey, feel free at the right times, come in, keep the cows on this for a day, graze it 3 times throughout the year. If you're doing that, you're probably, depending on the size of that operation, let's just say it is 30 cows. You're putting out a bale or two a day, and you tell that farmer, go out there and graze it 3-4 times during the fall, winter, and spring time frame. You've probably then saved that guy 8 bales or more, and $50 a pop. That's a considerable amount of money for something that he just said, all he had to do was give the okay for you to do it, and you know now the added advantage that it has from the wildlife standpoint too. I think that if there's farmers out there and they're looking for the ability to, from their land, one, increase the amount of productiveness on it, one, but two, in income potential, think about how many, like I guess the differences between let's just say northern Missouri rent ground for hunting leases versus southern Missouri hunting ground. You know, if a guy is out there saying, I really want to have some additional income, I'm going to lease it out for hunting. So instead of getting $5 an acre or something like that, I'm going to plant some pastures, do some of this stuff you guys are talking about, and I'm going to charge $10 because everything is food. Everything
yeah.
is food for wildlife, and now it's a extremely productive area. This is going to capitalize and go on and on and on. But like, you can take, let's say, less desirable from an aspect of hunting in a lot of people's mind and make it that much better if you cover X amount of acres on a whole farm.
For sure. Think about not even just pastures, but crop ground. How many crop fields do we see that where they cut and they sit vacant all fall and winter?
Unfortunately, and like, when we went to North Missouri, crop, we saw a bunch the other day.
Yeah, you could cover crop that and have grazing as well as improved erosion control, improved water quality, improved less inputs, less fertilizer, herbicide, less invasive weeds or problematic species because of the cover crop. There's all kinds of research that proves cover crops are beneficial from just the cattle or the crop farming side. Not only for that, though, but we're looking at it from the grazing side where you could graze it a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, when you're not grazing it, even when you are, depending on what kind of herd you're running, you've got the benefit to the wildlife.
It's incredible.
And that right there is exactly what was here occurring and what made our soil so beneficial, so nutrient rich, is those rotations of large grazing animals moving across.
Yeah.
Well, the thing that so many people miss is if you're fellas out there that are interested in soil health, if you're looking to improve and maximize your soil health, you're only going to take it to a very, you're going to take a few steps, but you're missing big picture if you're not trying to include grazing animals in that operation. You can try to replicate nature. You can try to do certain things.
You'll get there, but
until
the
cattle get there, you're not going to see that full big picture component where you're going to see the healthy soils that really were on the native prairies following the large bison herds.
Well, let's think about it. I mean, how many farmers are in the position where, you know, you've got tough winters up north or just, you know, decently mild winters here. But during the wintertime, think about the manure and the distribution of that manure across the pasture. It's extremely isolated into where the bale rings are being fed or the bale wagon is at. You have a high density of urine and feces right there in and around those rings for 4, 3, 5 months, wherever you're at,
yeah,
across the whole farm. But if you just go in again and do this type of cover cropping and the right pastures, choose the right forages based on the forages you have present, if you do that, now you're continuing more of a 12-month distribution of all that fertilizer across your entire farm, not just in these concentrated areas that get mucked up, they're getting nasty. If it's soupy, if it rains, if it gets warmer during the wintertime, you know how many farms we saw last year with the amount of rain we had and some warm spells? Like, people were getting tractors stuck in pastures because it was just soupy, nasty mess.
No, yeah.
And it's like, you don't have to necessarily worry about that or worry about that to the same degree. And know when you do warm up, that soil temperature is warming up and the stuff you planted is probably growing if you chose the right stuff.
That's an interesting point, too, because that brings up, you know, if you are in an operation, so I'm speaking of the guys who dad or grandpa or uncles running the cattle operation, and they're like, I wish there was some stuff I could do to make it more wildlife friendly. Thinking about all those bale ring areas.
Turn it up and hit the share button.
Or a lot of those spots where they fed hay,
mm-hmm,
and you see that disturbance on the soil and you're like, oh, what, man, this whatever, in February, March, or even this time of year, if they're already, hopefully they're not feeding hay yet.
I hope not.
Go ahead and start broadcasting some of those perennial clovers in those areas. Yeah. It's a great spot to then you have these hot spots of beneficial species, not only the cattle, but the wildlife as well.
And let's then not to forget about the fact that these forages that we're planting during the fall annuals, and we haven't even talked about summer annuals, but let's just do that for another podcast. But let's not forget that these are active root systems growing and mining different nutrients into these pastures. So your pastures, it's not only that you're increasing the production of the pasture from a forage standpoint throughout the entire year, but come springtime, what is that base of fescue and the clovers and everything else you've added to the food plot? It's in an incredibly productive state because it's been in those soils having nutrients mined the entire year and, you know, continuing to grow and have an active root system right there, right next to the fescue.
That's right.
In all of it. Or the smooth brome, whatever it may be. But we can't forget about the productiveness of the soil that this addition is helping the wildlife, helping grazing, helping the soil. It just doesn't, the benefits far, far, far outweigh the additional labor, because truthfully, if you graze those things right, you're reducing labor from breaking your back, throwing hay bales around, moving hay bales during the summer, whatever, and then doing the same thing in the wintertime to feed.
Yeah, so we've got planting times. You know, when it comes to planting a lot of these, let's say, cool season annuals, you can plant cereal rye and wheat up till even November in some places. I've seen places where they planted cereal rye. If you're down south, you could be planting it even into December. Yeah. I think it's 35 degrees or something
like
that.
It's right in that window, yeah.
And so you can plant all the way up until that point. So anytime from you want to plant those cereal grains a little later than you do your brassicas. So anytime from, and this is very, I mean, it's very broad. I'm trying to cover 48 states here, so I don't think we have many listeners in Hawaii and Alaska, but anywhere from August to October, let's say, yep, even into November if you're down south. And that could go from the cool season annuals of wheat, rye, turnips.
A lot of clovers,
cool
too.
Season, or yeah, your annual, seam, your annual early, clovers. And then that crimson also includes your perennial, a lot of your perennial cool seasons, yep, your red clover, white clovers, and then also your chicory.
Yep.
But then you can take that and turn around and plant again. Another planting window would be in that February, March, the frost seeding window, where you're planting those little hard seeds like your clovers. And then you could, when I say clovers there, I'm talking about your perennial clovers. Your annual clover is a little bit bigger than your perennial clovers, but
depending on how hard pastures were grazed or the condition that they're in after a wintertime, you could potentially do that, because I've seen a lot of pastures that have a ton of bare ground on them during February and March time frame.
Oh, for sure. For sure. You could sneak a lot of beneficial seed on your grandpa's pasture, yeah, then and go, where did that come from?
Do it at night.
You know exactly where
it
comes
from. Do it at night. Don't say a word. And just sit back and let it happen. Yeah. And then listen to it. Say, oh, I didn't know all this. Look at all this, all that, and that. You're like, yeah, I did that, Grandpa.
Yeah. Another window would be March and April, and some of your spring oats, spring peas, certain, yep, things like that, that you could then plant to get some beneficial species in that, another stressful period of time. So then let's fast forward and you're looking at your summer annuals that you might be adding to some pastures. And we're talking about, did we even mention this, or we talk about this on another podcast?
We'll talk about it.
So that would be the planting window for those summer annuals, would be April and May. And some of them you could even get into June and July. Buckwheat, you could plant even in July and early August.
Sorghum sedan, Milo. Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of different things that you can do, add to those pastures in that window. So a lot of times, and here's one thing that here's the balance of it all, is do you cut hay early, or do you let it go on and get more mature, and from a nesting and from a fawn standpoint? Because there's a lot of farmers who will want to cut hay early, let's just say first part of May, late April, and they're doing that before a lot of nesting can occur. There's definitely some for sure, but before a lot of fawns drop, and they're actually harvesting the better quality hay because it's a lot more vegetative state. So you could do that window and then come in right behind that and drill in some of these additional summer annuals, like you mentioned, or delay the hay cutting, let it get more mature, wait for the nesting to occur, the fawns to drop, be able to run out of the way, do that game, and then come back in with your buckwheat, your Milo, sorghum sedan, sun hemp if you wanted to. You could do all sorts of things, yeah, because that window at that point is when a lot of the cool seasons are really tailing off.
Yeah.
Later into June, certainly July, you're going to have a lot better success rate less competition from a growing standpoint with the cool season that's present in that pasture versus these annuals.
Yeah, for sure. And hopefully some guys got their wheels turning and they're looking to find ways, because there's a lot of people that are hunting ground, hunting pieces of property that have cattle, and they're trying to figure out, they're looking at vast acres of hay pastures or grazing pastures, going, man, I wish there was something benefiting the wildlife there.
And here's one thing too, don't expect it to look like every single food plot you've planted in the past. It's not going to be the exact same. You might not get the exact same growth because, yes, there's other forages in there that are still cool seasons. However, you can still make those acres much more beneficial than what they are if you don't, for wildlife and livestock included.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully everybody enjoyed it. Shoot us an email if you have any questions at info@landandlegacy.tv. And we'd be glad to help you, give you some guidance, and maybe walk through your operation and how we can help you improve it.
No doubt.
Go check out our YouTube channel, Land and Legacy. A lot of videos dropping. Recent video is the first deer harvest of the year for us. Shot a big doe out of a tethered saddle. It was the first tethered hunt for both of us, first saddle hunt for us, and it paid off big time. We did exactly what we planned with the saddle. So go check that out, and go check out the other podcasts as we describe what happened. So
no doubt. And new hats are online too.
Yes.
Shop.landlegacy.com.
Whitetail hats are back in stock. Two color options now, the tricolor, blue, gold, cream colored, and then the brown whitetail hat. So help support us. Once again, $5 of each purchase goes straight to QDMA.
Absolutely.
All right, guys. Thanks again.
We'll see you guys next week.
Yep.